Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Oh, tonight we got them. Goldie the Sulk and JC.
The chemical, disgusting,
and it starts right now.
Oh, welcome back to another episode of A Typical Disgusting Display, a podcast for writers by writers who hate writing. Goldie, the buzz all week has been about your Golden Globes monologue that you came up with in a half hour and was
incredible.
20 times better than what the actual Golden Globes monologue was. I've heard from literally many people about how impressed they were. People we've worked with, David Goodman, reached out to me. You know, I was actually giving David Goodman shit during the Emmys last night, and he's like, "I'm not watching. I'm listening to Goldie's monologue. It's unbelievable." That was nice. And I'm sure you saw some of the comments on Instagram. Mike D's buddy Rep wrote a very funny comment saying like something to the effect of Goldie made up for it with that Golden Globes monologue, which I have no idea what you were making up for, but I love that he just leaded with that. But it was so funny. And I was thinking all week, I was laughing all week rather about the Oppenheimer joke of going in on a first date, and by the time you're leaving, she's asking where this relationship is going. So funny. So with that in mind, the Emmys were last night. And I know there was also playoff football. I myself was switching back and forth, but I made a point of like, I want to watch the opening monologue just because you did your monologue. We've been talking about monologues a lot recently. And I thought they did a great job because it was, okay, it was Anthony Anderson from Black-ish was the host. And since it was the 75th Emmys, they were doing all night like a tribute to the great television shows, you know, of all time. They had a Cheers thing. They had Tina and Amy came back to do an SNL weekend update. They honored the cast of Martin. They were all there. It was really nice. And so what I thought they did so well in this monologue that the Golden Globes did not get right was the Golden Globes got up and Joe Coy was kind of doing like a worse version of Ricky Gervais, where he got up there and he was doing a little sort of insulty shtick about the nominees, and it did not play well.
Yeah.
What they did on the Emmys, and this is, I mean, this was a lesson that television taught to the movies. So what they did on the Emmys was they're not there to shit on anyone. They were there to warmly embrace and make everyone feel good about what we had done. Anthony Anderson is a very likable, charismatic guy. He did not get up there and, you know, rat-a-tat-tat insults. What he did was he said, "We're celebrating television tonight." He sat down behind the piano. They had a choir come out and they instantly break out into the theme from Good Times. And then they sort of segued into the theme from, I forget, it was like Cheers. And, you know, they did just a bunch of that. Yeah. And I at the end of the monologue, I was feeling like, I'm so happy right now.
Yeah,
that just felt like a warm blanket that they just gave me from TV. So it's sort of a lesson in like, okay, you don't always, the Ricky Gervais model may just apply to Ricky Gervais.
Right.
And maybe there's another way to go with some of these monologues where, you know what, just come out there and make everybody feel good and that's okay.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know if any of you two saw the Emmys or had any thoughts on that, but I just felt like it was a nice way, a nice response from the television industry.
It sounds nice.
Well, first of all, I was watching the football game, and so I don't have any jokes, but this week I have 30 plays that the Eagles should have run that I want to just go through.
First joke of the day. First joke of the day.
X, Y, fly right.
Come out, you go right into a screen. Okay.
You got to. You get the defense flowing one way, you go the other way.
Well, look, one of my theories, and I don't know whether I've said it on this podcast or not, is everyone wants comedy until they get it.
Right. Yeah.
So there's maybe a misconception that, like, you know, you'll come out and you'll keep it light and you'll make a little bit of fun of it. But the second you say, you know, Clint Eastwood, and it's like, no,
yeah,
no, not him,
no,
our sacred idol, you know, May, December, that was a great film.
Yeah, how dare you?
You know, so sure, I mean, going out there and playing the piano and giving a concert and telling one how awesome they are, it's kind of a cheat code. Like, I don't have a,
it worked.
It's, I'm sure it worked. Yeah, it's not comedy.
But right. You know what?
It's entertainment.
They yes. did put some jokes in it, but they weren't jokes about like, hey, this person's weird. That thing kind of sucked. It was more just like incidental jokes in a kind of dinner theater type setting, which doesn't right. sound sure. great, but it was very nice. And I thought my cap is off to the producers of that show for
I mean, it's a little
choice.
Outlandish that we take what are these trade shows essentially for, you know, excellence within a trade or craft, and then expect them to be national entertainment events,
right?
Right.
Because it's any other industry, you would just go like, who would care, you know, who the industrialist of the year is or
right
whatever.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know, it's all fine. It's not, I mean, listen, I've been doing this since 2002. I've never even sniffed an award of any kind. So
they smell great.
At this point, my interest in it is so, I mean, I'm so far afield of that part of it that I don't know. I can't look at it accurately. So of course, if you let me in there, I would just insult everyone in the room out of anger. But that's not everyone's reaction.
Right.
So, you know, like, I don't want to see them honored particularly. I want to see them taken down. Because I'm jealous and angry and hate them all. And I don't genuinely, I think most of their work is genuinely terrible. And it just gets amplified. And then we all go into this collective psychosis of, oh, that was, you know, whenever you start hearing words like, you know, a tapestry, it's like, well, how is that a fucking tapestry of anything? Or it's or, like these words they use, of these words of acclaim. They're so nebulous and meaningless, and they're indications that either no one understands it or it's bad except to a few people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or that they're scared of saying anything about it because of the backlash, that it would be viewed as an attack on a group, and you, it would paint you as aligned with a set of beliefs that would horrify you.
Right. Right.
So like the word a triumph. If you see anything as a triumph, it isn't. Right. It's not a triumph, okay? It's a movie that might be good. It's not, oh, a triumph. Like, a triumph means you were fucking bored.
Right. That's a good deconstruction of triumph.
Yeah.
Something else that I noticed that happens a lot in these situations is, you know, 75th anniversary of the Emmys. Okay, we're celebrating.
We're celebrating everything that happened 30 years ago or more.
Right. So we're honoring legends, and a lot of them are here. So, you know,
Can I just say the one thing I did see?
Yes.
Because my wife called me in. Was the In Memoriam reel, and the whole thing started on Norman Lear's stupid fucking hat.
Oh, God.
So instantly, she called me in to say like, oh, I know this is kind of like a more interesting part. But then I was like, I saw the hat. Everything went fucking white.
Oh, no.
And then I just instantly enraged her by making fun of the whole thing.
Well, yeah, you can't.
Like, no one's like, oh, his hat, that stupid hat he wore everywhere. Like, that was the one bad decision he made, was wearing that dumb hat. Yeah. And now you're going like, oh, remember the hat? Like, no, I remember all the great things he did. I hated the hat, personally. I'm glad the hat's gone.
Oh, the hat's still here, my friend.
I miss the man. I don't miss his poor hat choice.
Well, yes, you cannot be held responsible for anything that you say after seeing that hat. We get that. Oh, but one of the things,
but then the rest of America would go like, not the hat. Like, oh, well, I know how to get him. We'll show the hat.
Oh God, it brings a tear to your eye, that hat, every time. But what one of the things they do in these situations, which they definitely did last night way too many times, was it would be like, ladies and gentlemen, Miss Carol Burnett, you know, and then you get the predictable standing ovation. Yeah. She comes out from behind the curtain. Everybody's sussing out, like, how does she look? How's she speaking? And she looked good and she sounded good. But the thing is, it's like Carol Burnett comes out, gives like a little, you know, 30-second speech about her show and the history of television and all the greatness and how happy she was.
And I'm 50 and I'm 51. I barely remember that, but
sure. Yeah, exactly. But then it rolls instantly from like, and for 11 years on CBS and 40 million people a night and blah blah blah, and now here are the nominees for Best Supporting Actress in a Limited Series or Event. And then, so it goes right from Carol Burnett, this greatness, to like a winner that you've never heard of, who rushes the stage like Kyle Juszczyk, a fullback in the NFL, like stiff arms Carol Burnett out of the way to get her award, and then is giving a speech, and you see Carol Burnett sadly shuffling off into the wings. And it's just like, you get this impression of TV is like, okay, you were the queen for over 10 years. You ruled television, and now you have 30 seconds and you're gone.
Oh, yeah. It would be so great if they just were like, and here's Mr. Beast.
Yeah. You know,
like, right. Everyone in the world is losing their mind.
Right. Anyway, boy, this is clearly the time of year for our industry where we get to watch a lot of this stuff.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
But now is the time of the show where we get to wreck it by doing some Johnny jokes.
From Hollywood, home of legends and triumphs, and here's Johnny.
Yes, and we are back. Okay.
By the way, all those legends, they all paid like $8,000 for their mansions in Bel Air.
I know.
Then they act like, you know, I don't know what's wrong with people of today. Shut up.
Shut up. Shut up, you legend.
Lucky legend. You got out of here. Pico was farmland.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't get the anger.
Pico was farmed.
There was like 5 million less people here.
All right. Let's get into it. Oh, maybe you heard this story. The makers of Fruit Stripe gum have announced that the brand will be discontinued. That's sad. One insider said the news was intense for about 12 seconds, then faded away to nothing.
Oh.
Fruit Stripe, that's the way that was your experience with Fruit Stripe. Oh, here's a complex story out of the Middle East. Taking a page out of the Vietnamese playbook. Ooh. Sex workers in Yemen are being told to seduce American soldiers should there be a land invasion. The reports are unconfirmed, but for now, all soldiers are being advised to avoid Ruthie the Toothy Houthi. Ruthie the Toothy Houthi.
Houthi? Like hussy?
Houthi, I think, is the name of the new terrorist group who we're fighting down
oh,
there.
God.
Let's open a paper there, JC.
Okay. Paper.
Open a newspaper.
Right.
Now let's see on this next one. I need a prop.
Oh, these are the best.
Paper here. Okay, here's a Karnak. Ted Kennedy, Killers of the Flower Moon, and the Dallas Cowboys. Can't rip a piece of paper. Name a boozer, a snoozer, and a loser. Boozer, a snoozer, and a loser. Yes, and going right into the next story, the Dallas Cowboys lost to the Packers last week, continuing their disappointments in the postseason. Things are so bad in Dallas.
How bad are they?
Things are so bad that after the game, the team bus was diverted through Dealey Plaza. They are so bad that NASA is asking struggling astronauts to now say, Dallas, we have a problem. They are so bad that Debbie is now doing Green Bay.
Good job.
Great.
Johnny, too. Thank you.
Great job. It's funny we're going right into this. This week, an unprecedented cold spell is sweeping through Los Angeles. It's so cold.
How cold is it?
It's so cold, the movie May December changed its name to November January. It's so cold, Bradley Cooper is wearing a prosthetic jacket. It's so cold, even Joe Coy has relative heat.
That's awesome.
Excellent.
I love how not planned that was. Yeah. That was amazing.
Well, a woman is claiming she now has lifelong diarrhea after taking Ozempic. Huh. So Ozempic makes you Jewish? Okay. The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA,
yes,
is making a push to hire people with intellectual disabilities and severe psychological problems. The agency is having a hard time finding anyone with those conditions because they're already working for American Airlines. This week, Germany warned that Russia is preparing to start World War III. An official German spokesman said, "That's our job." And finally, Norm Snead, the former quarterback for the New York Giants, died at 84.
Yeah.
And next year, he'll be starting for the Cowboys.
Oh, great batch.
Those
great
are amazing.
Stuff. Oh.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Friends, listeners, we're excited today because we have an old friend here, and now someone who, like many people in our lives, has just skyrocketed past us on the Hollywood ladder. Today, we are going to be talking to writer Michael Kennedy, and he has written movies, actual movies. We're stuck in a small screen. He's on the big screen. The excellent horror film, Freaky, so funny and scary. In 2020 with Vince Vaughn, and now he's just released It's a Wonderful Knife, which is another incredibly fun, scary thrill ride that was out in theaters, and now you can get it on Amazon and other places.
On TV with the rest of us.
Right. And so it's back on TV where we all belong. You can get it on Amazon and a few other places that I'm too old to figure out, but Amazon is a safe bet for people like me. Folks, please welcome Mr. Michael Kennedy. Michael, how are you?
Good, thanks, dude.
You're welcome.
And we were just talking before we went on air here. Tell the folks what glamorous location you're in right now.
I fleed to the Cleve, as they say on 30 Rock. Yeah, I'm in Cleveland.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now Cleveland is your hometown.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So that's where I'm from.
So growing up in Cleveland, was the goal to get out of Cleveland?
Yeah. About mid, you know, once I entered my teen years and, you know, I loved Cleveland growing up until I was, you know, at that age when everyone else figured out I was gay before I did.
Right.
And started to get hammered all the time with teasing and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
So I wanted to get out of there for that. But then I eventually fell in love with film as a teenager.
Yeah.
And knew I wanted to come out to LA to do that at some point.
Wow. Okay. You knew.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I saw Scream when I was 16, and it was the first scary movie I ever saw. Weirdly enough, I didn't grow up watching scary movies. They scared me too much.
Right.
Right.
That tracks.
Yeah. My brother, actually, when I was like 8 years old, I remember him sitting down to watch Halloween back in the day when you could like turn your TV on a Saturday afternoon and like something on syndication would be playing.
Right.
Yeah. And I like freaked. I had to leave the room after like 2 minutes. And I would get scared of like commercials and stuff too.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah. So like my high school friends tricked me into seeing Scream, and thank God they did, because it like completely, I was obsessed with it immediately. And well, I walked out of the theater and saying, I'm going to make one of those one day. So
that's amazing.
That's amazing because you have, and you continue to now, but I wanted to, and let's talk about it since we're talking about it. So Scream, clearly, if you watch your movies, Freaky and It's a Wonderful Knife, Scream has had a big impact on you.
Very much so.
But there's a difference. You have changed it. You have twisted it, which I love, because it's one thing to see Scream and say, I love that, and then you make just a carbon copy. But you haven't done that. And something that I've noticed about both of your films, whereas Scream took the horror genre, sort of it deconstructed it, turned it on its head, made it kind of funny.
Yeah.
So it was a funny horror thing, which felt new at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like what you do, and tell me if this was part of your plan, it's almost like, yes, you've done what Scream did to horror movies, but you've also added this element, which is a Hallmark movie. It feels like your movies are set in these like idyllic locales.
Yeah.
They kind of fool you into thinking like, oh, this has the vibe of like a warm, comfy Hallmark movie. And then you turn that on its head. Was that something when you went into it, you said, yes, I want to do Scream, but I want to add this extra element to it?
Yeah. I mean, for Knife especially, it was completely like first 20 minutes, we talked a lot about how it was supposed to play like a Hallmark Christmas movie.
Right. Yeah.
Freaky, not so much, but Freaky, I think it kind of gives the Hallmark vibe just because I worked on that with Chris Landon, who did Happy Death Day, which, you know, is in a very similar mode. And he has a lot of heart in his work. And I put a lot of emotion and heart into my work, too. So, like, I think that vibe comes across a little bit because there is a like an emotional current rolling through Freaky, surprisingly. Like, when people see that movie, they're like, wait a minute, I cried. And it's like, there's like a kind of a coziness to them.
Well, tell the folks, because I remember when you were talking about Freaky way before it came out, when you were starting to write it or you had the idea for it, and tell the folks, because I was sold on this instantly. Tell the folks what your original title for Freaky was.
Freaky Friday the 13th.
That is such a great title. I cannot believe that you didn't win that. What happened there?
That was, I mean, it was the title all the way through shooting. It was the title in post.
Right.
And then we got a cease and desist from Disney.
For Freaky Friday.
Freaky Friday, yeah. Paramount, whoever owns Friday the 13th.
Paramount.
Yeah. It's about Friday the 13th. And it is, though, is like, you can't copyright a title. Like, you can use any title. Like, you can repeat someone's title. But I think, from what I recall, I think Universal was like, it's just not worth the trouble. Like,
I see.
You know, I think
to Disney go up against Disney.
And paperwork and money and that kind of stuff. So,
right.
Chris Landon had the idea of just shortening it to Freaky, which I think
it does work. And you don't want to see the title Kennedy and DeSantis v. Disney. I don't think you want to be involved in that.
I don't want to share anything with DeSantis.
All right, now so talk for a minute, because boy, I mean, Vince Vaughn was so great in Freaky. So talk a little bit about, did you have him in mind, or how did that come about with Vince Vaughn?
Yeah, we weirdly enough, when we were writing the script, we had Catherine Newton in mind for Millie, who ended up being in the movie. And then we had a couple people in mind for the Butcher, and Vince was one. And I remember Chris saying, we'll never get both. We'll be lucky if we get one. We'll probably get neither of them.
Incredible.
Yeah, we ended up getting both. But weirdly with Vince, it was his agency was pushing him really hard to Chris. So like once that started happening, we knew that we had a really good shot at getting him for the film.
Wow.
And at the time he was looking to do, because he had kind of started doing like those hardcore, like gritty indie films there for a minute.
Yeah.
Right.
And he was looking to come back and do like a studio comedy at the time. Amazing. So like it was perfect timing. He read the script and loved it. So he was like, get me in that movie to his reps. And Chris was like, we were already thinking about him. So they met once.
How does that dance start, do you think? Like how many scripts is he looking at a given time? And
I would think a lot, right? Like, I don't know. I can't imagine he didn't have several on his desk that he was looking at, but who knows? It always surprises me when you find out that like, you know, some major stars, like I'm sitting around waiting for a script and I don't
know. So it's like he's in a script restaurant and he's basically like got a menu.
From the menu.
And he just sort of then picks whatever and that you think they schedule that for him. I mean, I don't know.
I'm assuming so. I mean, because Chris and him shared the same agency too. So I'm sure that probably was part of it. I'm sure internally WME was like, who do we have that we can push for the movie?
I wouldn't know. I was there years and I never encountered a single celebrity. That's why I'm asking. I literally have no idea.
So describe a little bit, because you must have been just kind of over the moon when shooting actually started on Freaky. And so describe like watching Vince on his day one. And did you have this feeling like, oh, fuck yes.
Yeah. So the first scene we shot was Vince with Nyla and Josh. So Celeste O'Connor and Misha Osharovich, who played the best friends. Yeah. It was the three of them in the bathroom. So the bathroom scene.
Yes.
Like right after they figure out that Millie's telling them the truth and she's stuck in this dude's body. And I think it was like the second take, he was flopping his dick. That was like the first scene of the movie. It was like him flopping his dick and saying stuff.
Yeah.
And I like cackled out loud. And I like, because I forgot where I was. And I was like, I was laughing out loud and like they had to yell cut. It was being, my laugh was being recorded, and Chris Lannan, thank God, he was so nice. He was like, "We're really filming." Laugh out loud until hey, you'll cut. So I remember that on the first, like the first 10 minutes. And yeah, it was nuts. It was just like the thing I remember being most struck by was that his real life personality is just like his character in Old School and all those old great like Wedding Crashers and shit. Like he's really that guy.
Yeah.
Did you have to fight to be on set, or were they just wanted you there? Because I know sometimes they, it's not totally typical for the writer.
No, it wasn't. It was what the situation was is I paid my own way. The studio was never going to let me on set, and I asked the director, because he's a good friend of mine, and I said, "Do you mind if I come? It's my first movie. I really want to learn as much."
That's
as
outlandish.
And I know.
And he said, "Yeah, like
that's
come
so
for
nice,
the whole shit. Come for the whole shit." In fact, I stayed with him, so I didn't have to like pay for my own housing and shit too. He's like, "Stay in my house." Like
incredible.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. Yeah, see, for me, it was like. You know,
on Ted, are you there?
On Ted and Ted 2. Well, Seth is different with his writers because he wants them there in case, right. You know, we need to like come up. And Goldie was on set for a couple of those movies too, where if he needs jokes, you know, he wants you there. But by the time we got to Ted 2, I was like as far away from set as possible until I was summoned. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm 10 minutes away. I'd be like an hour and a half away. But it you do have this feeling like, oh my God, I want to be there for the magic. And then like on the first late night, you're like, oh God, get
yeah,
me
you realize
out of here.
How boring it can be.
Yeah.
I really loved it though, because like Chris partly through was like, I'm so glad you're here, because I ended up having we had some weird shit happen. We had weather delays. In Atlanta, we had a day where we lost a day to the wind. Like the wind was so high that we couldn't shoot and stuff.
Wow.
And then we had like a tragic accident. Like this weird like thing happened with one of our crew people. That was like just a crazy accident. So we lost a location.
Wow.
And we had to find a new location for 2 days later and stuff. So like, thank God I was there, because I was able to like rewrite.
Oh, wow.
Scenes and stuff. And then like during the shoot, we realized, oh, we don't have a wrap up scene for our kids, like the kid characters. We didn't have a scene with them at the end of the movie, we realized.
Right.
So we wrote that on the fly one day.
Incredible.
Like 12 hours before he was gonna shoot it and stuff. So like he was like, thank God you're here. You know, he was putting out fires and doing all of his other stuff.
And paying for yourself.
Even better.
Yeah, even better.
What was so great, I mean, it was the perfect way to use Vince Vaughn, because mm-hmm. Vince is, you know, he's like this tall, handsome movie star, and he, you know, he's playing this brutal killer. And so, but that wouldn't be as fun to watch for an hour and a half or 2 hours of Vince Vaughn as just the butcher. Jason. So this idea, which is, you know, the crux of the movie, to have him body switch with a teenage girl, it really unlocked Vince's comedy. And it just makes the movie so enjoyable for the viewer. I mean, I watched it when it first came out, and then knowing this interview was coming up, I watched it on Delta Airlines. Shout out to
all right,
Delta.
All right,
it's
all right.
Available on Delta.
It is. I flew Delta here.
Oh, nice.
God, the screens keep getting smaller for this movie.
I know.
What's next? Are you going to get a pinhole camera?
Yeah, Apple Watch. Yeah, so... That's a great first experience for awesome. You and right cool. out of the gates you have success, you have people talking about it, it's like a profitable movie, which, you know, is not a given in this day and age. And so how long after Freaky do you say like, okay, I have my next idea?
Well, it's weird, like Chris and I we sold Freaky like really quick. Like awesome. We had planned to take Freaky out to the town on a Monday, and we gave Blumhouse like first shot because Chris has worked with them and I have a relationship with them too. So we gave the script to Jason Blum, who, if you're not familiar with him, he's like the king of horror, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, cool.
Production company is like the king.
Yeah, they're killing it.
Yeah, they're killing them. They just signed a huge deal. They just merged.
I think that's their motto.
They're killing it. Oh my
and
god.
And they merged with James Wan's company, you know, like heavy hitter. So we gave it to him on a Thursday. And he bought it Friday. So it never got to go to town, but it eventually, that kind of became a thing. Like, it was like, oh, wait, these two dudes just sold the script in like 24 hours. Who the fuck is that other guy?
Right.
But like, because everyone knew who Chris was. So then I started getting meetings really quickly.
That's so cool.
And I actually, like, before I even left for Freaky, I had already closed another deal on a movie because this company was looking for a specific slasher film. And they pitched me it and said, do you want to write it? So wow. That was how I got my second job.
Now, do you like that model better because it's less work? I mean, theoretically, you don't have to come up with the idea.
That was ended up being the most work I've ever done on a project because it like originated with the producer. So,
so it was like rewrites or something.
I did. Yeah, it was like insane.
That's for It's a Wonderful Knife.
No, that was another project. Oh, okay. That never ended up being made. Actually.
Okay. Wow.
Because of constant rewrites. Right. So then because of that experience, that's when I started putting Knife together on my own. But it really started to pop when Freaky came out. You know, it was a bummer. It came out during a high point in the pandemic. Like the week it came out, LA and New York City both closed their theaters. So like the Friday we were coming out, it was like only 32% of the country's theaters were open.
Whoa. The freakiest Friday.
Yeah, it was freaky. Yeah. It was a freak Friday. It was a Friday the 13th, too. So.
Oh, wow.
That's good marketing.
It was. And that's Universal stuck to it, not thinking maybe we wait a year to release this thing.
Oh, my God.
So it didn't do great in theaters just because of the fact they weren't fucking open. Like, I couldn't even go see my own movie that week, you know?
That's sad. God.
But the critical reaction was better than we expected. And then the industry reaction was insane. Like people all over the industry loved it, like execs and studio heads and stuff. So like, as soon as that movie opened by the start of 2021, I was in meetings like constantly.
Wow.
That's great. And
were you pitching or getting pitched or a combo
both.
Move?
A bit of both. Yeah.
Yeah.
Both. And then we had just finished lockdown too. Right. So I had written It's a Wonderful Knife during that. So like once lockdown was over, I took that script out and then, you know, put all those pieces together. That's why I produced that movie, because I basically put the whole movie together myself. Right.
Cool. And did you have to meet with the estate of Jimmy Stewart and Frank Capra to get that all cleared?
Could you imagine?
Oh, my God.
What are you talking about? That was like weird though, because it was like all the pieces came together really quick on it, but then it still took like 2 years for it to get made.
Right.
So during those 2 years, I got a lot of work. I'm like really busy right now, like crazy busy.
That's so cool.
Well, that's the best way to be.
Do you find that like you seem to love the horror genre and
want to stick?
So you're not someone who's like, as soon as I can get it out of horror then write,
I'm gonna write a freaking rom-com set in the 1700s. No, I'm sticking to horror. Yeah. I'm finding like I have four movies in various stages of pre-production right now.
Wow.
Of development. And the thing that's great about the horror genre is all four of them are like very different, you know? So like, that's what I love. I can stay in the genre and not feel like I'm repeating myself.
Yes. Now, do you have any catchy titles that you want to throw at us for any of the ones you have in development?
There's one called Heart Eyes, which is after the heart eyes emoji. The killer wears a mask of the heart eyes emoji.
Oh, wow.
Love that. I love that. I had an idea for you. I was thinking of this the other day. This is like my own personal horror movie. When you get a text from an unknown number that just says, hey. just call the movie Hey.
Scary. Yeah, Hey.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out a way to write a horror movie that's just called You Up.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what that story is.
Yeah. On a serious note, when you write, do you find like you have a title first and then you kind of go, this would be a good title and that inspires a story? Or do you have a story first, or do you just have like a particular way someone gets murdered first, or is there no pattern at all?
There's really no pattern. I mean, for Freaky, it was, I literally was watching Happy Death Day. And if you're not familiar with Happy Death Day, that's essentially Groundhog Day, the slasher.
Right.
But it's got a really strong emotional current to it. And at the time, I didn't know Chris Landon yet. I knew of his work, but I didn't know him personally. And my dad had just died. And there's a scene in that movie where the main character is meeting her mother, who's dead in her real life.
Right.
So to speak. So she's like, it's really emotional. I could actually cry thinking about the scene. It's a really well-written scene. It's really emotional. Jessica Roth is so great in the scene and stuff. And I knew Chris's history. Like, I knew his dad was Michael Landon. So, like, I knew his dad was dead. I knew his mom was dead and stuff. So I was like, right. I wonder if he's channeling, like, any of his grief in this, you know? And I, like, kind of broke down because my dad had died, like, 3 months earlier.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I, like, broke down. And I was like, maybe I should do something like that. Maybe I should channel my grief into something like this. So then my next immediate thought was, so this is my genesis of Freaky was, how do I rip off Happy Death Day? Right. I literally Googled best comedies of all time, and like there was like a top 100 list, and I was scrolling through the list and I found Freaky Friday.
Wow.
So then I spent half a day Googling to see if that, because I was convinced that movie already existed. I was like, someone had to make a body swap slasher. Like, there has to be one. Like, it's such a great idea. How am I the first person to think of this?
Right.
Sure enough, no one had thought of it crazily. So then that night at 2 o'clock, I woke up from a dream and had like half the plot in my head.
Wow.
I literally text myself like the Dola. I had the name of the knife, the Dola. I had how the body swap happened. I had like all this different shit. So I text myself it in the morning so I wouldn't forget.
Smart.
Text myself so I'd wake up in the morning and read it. So that's how that kind of started. Knife was kind of like both. I knew I wanted to play in the same kind of sandbox as Freaky. And I knew I wanted to do a Christmas movie. So like those were the two things I knew I wanted to do. So I said, well, what does a Freaky look like at Christmas? And I immediately thought of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, that's great.
I kind of started with a title in a way, you know.
That's so smart. Now you have this thing, because It's a Wonderful Knife, like Freaky had Vince Vaughn, It's a Wonderful Knife has Justin Long,
yeah,
who gives a fantastic performance. I mean, first of all, his dentures deserves their own award. Like his fake teeth were so funny. Like, it made that character like 20% funnier just by totally. His mouthiness when he would talk and smile. So in It's a Wonderful Knife, I don't want to give too much away to the listeners, but you have this really great thing where, and you, both movies do this, where they just, once they start, you're in it right away. Like there's no, a lot of horror movies have sort of like 35 minutes of buildup and then you realize kind of like what's going on. But in both Freaky and in It's a Wonderful Knife, you kind of get into it right away. Yeah. And It's a Wonderful Knife has this sort of an unexpected turn in the first 20 minutes where you kind of think to yourself like, well, is this movie over? Like what's happening? But then you have this great creative device where everything kind of changes up and you're back in this movie that you thought you were out of. So when you're writing, when you're sitting down to write, did you have that sort of plot scheme in mind, or was that something that you're just like, oh, this is cool as you were writing it?
No, yeah.
You just dream it like you always do?
And text yourself, you up.
Angry, angry that someone got a good idea in a dream.
I know. You and Paul McCartney.
Very similar. Very similar. I had two things in mind when I sat down to write it.
Yeah.
One was I knew I had the opportunity to write like basically an entire slasher movie in the first 15 pages.
Yes.
Because the first idea I had is, or first thought I had is, you know, when you watch It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart's only in I Don't Exist Land for like 15 minutes. It's like right. at the very end of the movie and stuff. So my first thought was, I want to move that up. That needs to happen at the end of Act One.
Right.
So then Act Two is like the big, you know, big long Act Two with that kind of stuff. And then, you know, short Act Three. So I knew that was going to be the case. And then once I figured that out, I was like, oh, the first act is essentially a mini slasher movie.
Right.
You know, you kill a bunch of people, you identify who the final girl is, you identify the killer. And I also knew it was an opportunity to kind of do what Scream does so well, which is have a blow the doors off opening set piece. But then I also get to reveal the killer in the process.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't work if you don't reveal the killer in the first one.
So you seem to have this really good knowledge of structure, which is something I envy. I don't have
that. When it comes to slasher movies, yes, I have a very good.
Yeah, I mean, so this is my question. Is this just from a lifetime of enjoying these movies or schooling, or do you like books, or just more your innate sense?
It's definitely a lifetime of watching these things. Like once I became obsessed with slasher movies, I had the best video store in college. I went to college at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, which was like 25,000 students in a town of 30,000 people. And right. 25 of those were students, you know? So we had these like really awesome old school mom and pop video stores. And one of them, I remember in particular, Video Spectrum, the dude loved horror. The guy that owned it loved horror movies. So half this old house he converted into a movie store was a horror section. And he had so many horror movies that he literally had to flatten the cases and laminate them because he didn't have enough shelf space. So he had a record drawer, you know? And I just ate them up like fucking like breakfast every day. And my roommates, thank God, were super into movies and stuff too. So like I would just come home some days with like the three most trashiest movies you could think of. And just really, I don't know, it was like a weird, at the time I didn't realize I was doing it, but I think it was like a mini little film school.
Yeah, that's so cool. God, yeah. I miss video stores so much.
I do too. But the other way too, which you guys are going to be surprised by, was when I was a PA at Family Guy, I moved out to LA to write, and I thought I knew what the fuck I was doing. I was at Family Guy for like 2 days and was like, holy shit, you have no fucking clue what's going on. But you guys, I don't know if you remember this, but all you writers had, all your scripts were in our office that got you hired on the show. I remember that first week just taking home everyone's scripts and just reading them and really learning.
That's so smart.
Yeah, through spec scripts and Family Guy scripts. And like the first script I remember collating at Family Guy was Cherry's And Then There Were None, I think was the name of it.
Yeah, that's Seth's favorite.
Yeah, and that's like a really great structured script. It was like perfectly structured by act and stuff too, you know? So like I learned a lot at Family Guy, just reading all your guys' shit.
That's amazing. Well, yeah, Cherry's a fucking great writer. And that was that was an awesome script. And Seth always talks about how that's his favorite of all of them.
We'll do a sequel episode to that.
Oh, I'm sure he'd be into that. We'll suggest that and take full credit. Scream aside, because obviously that had a profound effect on you, being the first horror movie you really ever sat through, what are some of your other favorite horror movies?
I'm a classic person. Like I actually get shit from other horror people sometimes because like, oh, you're so basic. But Halloween, Exorcist.
Sure.
The second Friday the 13th.
We've talked about this.
You and I have talked about this a lot.
That was filmed at my summer camp. We moved.
Oh yeah.
Before. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. How cool. Those first two Friday the 13ths really don't get enough credit. I don't think they're both
so good.
Fantastic. And
I love horror movies. And those first two Friday the 13th part two, you're dead on that for some reason. And what you know, what a lot of people don't know, is that the hockey mask doesn't come in until part three.
No, and I think that's the scariest Jason is in part two when he's wearing a sack. A
burlap sack over his head.
So fucking
scary.
Yeah.
But that Friday the 13th part two is structured perfectly. Like it's got a perfect structure. Every set piece is really well timed and suspenseful and stuff. I love that movie. And plus then the chase scene at the end of the movie, which is like 20 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, I'm big on classics. The original Black Christmas, very spooky movie.
Right.
Jaws, love Jaws. And then a lot of the 90s stuff, like Scream.
Do you get into, because Frank, I love horror movies as well. And some of the scariest ones I've ever seen are more modern, like a movie like Hereditary or The Conjuring.
The Conjuring is really scary.
Yeah, are these movies that you do you set out to watch all these movies as well? And do you enjoy the modern horror films?
Oh, yeah. The thing I love about modern horror right now is I feel like every decade before the 2020s or even the 2010s, you could kind of define each decade by like what was popular in horror. You know, like the 60s and 70s was kind of like religious kind of horror, you know, with like The Omen and The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And then the 80s was the slasher, and then the 90s was kind of the meta movie.
Wow. Yeah.
And 2000s was like torture porn, relaxed.
Right, Saw.
Yeah, like Saw and Hostel and shit. Mm-hmm. The thing I love about now is that you can't define it by one subgenre because I think it's the first time in history where every single genre is popular and working in theaters and people are actually like leaving their house to go see a movie.
Yeah.
But I really love the way modern horror is just like you can get a different flavor.
Yes.
Like, by looking up the movies for the week, you know.
Right.
it's so interesting to me because it's really a genre I struggle to watch because I'm so squeamish. Like it almost works too well on me, so I can't watch the movies because I get terrified. But like, what is it in you that you think allows you to enjoy watching? Not enjoy necessarily, but if I see someone get killed, I'm like really disturbed. Like I'm genuinely disturbed by it. And how do you think intellectually you can compartmentalize like I'm being entertained versus like I feel actual horror when I watch horror and I don't enjoy feeling that way. I'm wondering how that turns into relish.
Well, you know, what's interesting is as I've gotten older, I've gotten a little more squeamish. You know, my friend Phil runs Fangoria magazine. He's the editor in chief. And he once wrote this piece about after he turned 40, he started feeling different watching scary movies just based on kind of what you were saying, Julius. And he was, in his own mind, he was likening it to after 40, you're starting downhill and you're going towards death as opposed mm-hmm. to going away from being born. So you start realizing your own mortality. And I think I kind of agree with him because I've noticed in some movies, I do have a different reaction than I would have 20 years ago. Like 20 years ago, I was like, fuck yeah, chop her head off. You know, like now and maybe that's why I write these slashers that are a little bit more like Alex said, like Hallmark.
Well, yeah, it's so you know, add some comedic element. I mean, do you think, are there movies that you watch that you're like, that was genuinely disturbing?
I thought Talk to Me was terrifying. I don't know if you saw Talk to Me. It's an A24 movie. It's essentially a monkey paw type of thing. It's like that hand.
Right.
And it connects you to the dead and stuff. It's terrifying. Oh. There's a scene in that movie. Did you see it, JC?
No, I can't.
Yes, there's a scene in that movie where I literally was in the theater like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it through this movie.
Oh my God. It must be terrifying.
It was really scary and it's really well done. And that's what I get through. If I get too scared or I feel like some sort of like, oh, I feel bad.
Yeah.
I start just then kind of thinking, oh, this is a really well-made movie then. Like,
yeah.
Well, directed it. Like they sure as shit scare the shit out of me. So they knew what they were doing.
Well, let's talk for a second because I feel like traditionally horror movies and comedies, I think, get overlooked when it comes to awards.
Oh, yeah.
It's just sort of everybody feels comfortable saying like, well, that's a horror movie, so we don't really have to look at it. But when I was watching Freaky, I kept thinking like, boy, Vince Vaughn could have really been nominated for something.
He could have been nominated for a Golden Globe, if you ask me.
Right.
He's a Golden Globe.
Because his performance was so fun, and also he did a lot. Like because he's Vince Vaughn, and yes, he's funny. He's got the rapid fire delivery. You know, he's does all that stuff so well. We know that. But he was also really physically kind of transforming himself into a teenage girl in the movie, which is not, you know,
not easy. It could become parody really quickly.
Exactly. Like he didn't do the thing of like making it way over the top. So it was like, oh, he's imitating being a girl. And now I find that offensive because it's 2020. Right. But it was more like he just did a lot of little stuff with his physicality, with his line deliveries.
Yeah.
And what do you think it'll take for a horror movie to break through?
Honestly, no idea. If Toni Collette couldn't get nominated for Hereditary, I don't know what. I mean, that was like an amazing performance.
Is Get Out considered a horror movie?
Yeah. It is. So that was like a breakthrough. I thought that might be like the thing that kind of busts the door open and maybe you'd start seeing more, but we haven't seen any since. True. You know, but I Toni Collette, she doesn't get nominated for Best Actress for Hereditary. I don't know what it's going to take.
It's
an amazing performance.
So good. So tough to watch, especially in particular her end in that movie. I was like, what am I watching?
Fucking dinner scene where she tells her kid, like, wipe that face off your face. That whole monologue.
Yeah.
But then her Oscar reel.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Let's talk for a minute about, the killer, the angel in It's a Wonderful Knife. What a cool outfit. What was the inspiration for that killer's outfit? Because I'd never seen anything like that before.
Pretty cool, right? So when I sat down to write it, I knew I didn't want to do a killer Santa because that's kind of the way people always go in Christmas horror. If it's a slasher, they always immediately put the killer in a Santa outfit.
Right.
Yeah.
Then I started thinking about, okay, like what's another kind of religious-y figure that I could kind of like talk shit about, quite frankly.
Right.
Old Catholic, like a anti-Catholic Catholic.
Yeah.
Raised Catholic. And then the other thing that I thought too was like, oh, I have snow. I could kind of get away with the killer wearing all white.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we actually didn't have a ton of money, but there was supposed to be, the first time he was supposed to be revealed was supposed to be like rising out of a pile of snow. So like you'd walk by the pile and you wouldn't see the killer, and then he would just rise out of it.
That's
just
good.
That's scary. Right? We didn't have the money to do it, which sucked.
You didn't have the money for fake snow?
No money for the movie. We shot the movie in 18 days.
Wow.
Yeah. I like was like, oh, we need to do this. I was like literally like giving back my paycheck like every week, being like, here's a little more for this scene. Like it was nuts. Wow. So I knew I wanted all white. So then I just thought of an angel. So I was like, let's just call the killer the angel. So in the script, I actually describe it as the angel wearing white from head to toe with the white robe, a white mask, white, like white everything. And then a dagger that was gold and silver. So then the director, costume designer, and the production designer, they then sat down and had a meeting. And I only found this out recently. I guess the production designer in that meeting drew the dagger, which was great. She like, cause we talked about, is the angel going to have wings? And we're like, that seems a little stupid to have a killer running around with these like giant wings, like hide himself and run or anything. So she put those onto the blade, which was really cool. And then they, then the three of them and like the FX team, they just kind of came up with some mock-ups and stuff. And the director, based on my description, then said he wanted the mask to look like a frosted light bulb.
Christmas
light bulb, so stuff can lights can reflect off it and stuff. So yeah, they did a really good job of kind of taking my very basic, the killer's wearing all white, and turned it into what they turned it in. In fact, I just got that costume shipped to me. Last week. It's sitting in my house right now.
Oh, that's gonna be good for some pranks upcoming.
Yeah, I don't have the mask though. I'm gonna have to steal the mask from the director. But yeah, the mask is the best. And we had three different masks in the movie because we had like a all white one for close ups. Yeah. But you like literally can't see out of it. I put that mask on for 5 seconds and I almost threw up inside it because go wearing it. Whoa. And then we had like a kind of semi-translucent one so he could, the killer, our stunt person, Cody, could see if it wasn't like a chase scene and stuff. And then he had one where it was like literally like
eyes you
could see through so he could like chase people and shit, and they would digitally add the white.
It looks so cool.
Isn't it cool?
Like just instantly because of the outfit entered into the pantheon of
We got a lot of like a lot of great praise for it just because late the slasher movies have kind of done mask with a black hoodie.
You know,
we did the full costume I think for the first time in a while, which was really cool, and it had an original look, you know. So
absolutely
so cool. And now we talked a little bit before we started how when I was on Wikipedia preparing for this interview, what it said about you was genre gay horror. So now you mentioned earlier that yes, you are gay, but does that categorization bug you? Because that didn't seem like what was going on to me at all.
You know, it doesn't bother me at all. Actually, I really embrace it.
Good.
You know, when Chris and I wrote Freaky, we knew there was a really fun opportunity to kind of Trojan horse some conversation in about identity and that kind of stuff. You know, like, you know, we didn't want to do like, have you seen The Hot Chick?
Yes.
Yes.
Fucking love The Hot Chick. Yeah. It's so like misogynistic and like, you know, it just does everything so cheap.
Yeah.
Right. Chris and I knew like we didn't want to do that, but we also knew we had an opportunity as queer, both being gay men, to like kind of talk about some shit. And also like, you know, like the teacher that dies in that movie is based on a teacher I had. So whenever anyone's like, that teacher's so unreal, Alan Ruck is so unreal, I'm like, oh, you want to get in my time machine and you'll see how my science teacher talked to me when I was 16 and asked me if I was gay in front of the entire class.
Oh God.
Like, of course we should cut him in half.
Right. I love that.
It's so great, right? Like, it's like, ugh. And it was one take too.
Right on the bandsaw.
Fuck you, Alan Ruck. Alan Ruck is so great though.
That's so funny.
Like we knew there was going to be some identity conversation. And then the character of Josh is essentially the version of Chris, the version Chris and I wish we could have been as 17-year-olds in high school, like the gay person we could have been, like out and a little offensive and saying whatever he wanted and doing what he wanted. And
it's a great character.
Talk about having sex with straight dudes who are drunk and like just like being a little inappropriate. And then with Knife, it wasn't so much about that, but I knew as a producer, and I knew my producing partners were very supportive, that was an opportunity where I'm like, I'm going to make every single person in this movie a homosexual. Right. Like, I think there's 7 gay people in the movie and there's 2 non-binary characters. And I, like, of the cast, I think 10 of them were queer. Like, so I think people, yeah, I take it as like a banner, like a badge of honor, because like,
cool.
If I'm not going to do it, who's going to do it? So
yeah,
everything I write has either a gay character, a gay theme, something, you know?
Well, and also you're in step with the times. I mean,
yeah, like, it's like these people exist. They walk around your town all the time.
Absolutely. And know? So like, I found it funny because I noticed, when the movie came out on your Instagram, you were reposting like angry comments from people who had watched it, who were like, I liked the movie, but the gay agenda, you know, and it was just like,
cramming gayness down my throat. Voice of words.
I know. Well, it must make it easier for you to spot the gay people out there when you're like, oh, this guy's gay. He's really angry about it.
And I actually I pitched to the studio, like taking all those reviews and turning them into an advertisement, and like they wouldn't do it. I'm like, what are you afraid of? Like, but, you know, I forget what movie it was. Is it Thanksgiving, Eli Ross movie? There was a movie recently where they did that. The studio took a bunch of the
I'm not joking. They tried it with dads. They tried to take all the like offensive reviews and make a promo.
That's so smart.
And it just. It didn't
it's
work.
So smart. What else?
Nothing. Work. Nothing could save us at that point.
Well, let me ask you a side question. Like, do you find that your experience in this genre and your knowledge of it and your creating, when a crime is committed, do you think you're more adept than the average person at sussing out what happened?
True crime. You know what's funny though is like when I watch my husband and I love Dateline.
I do too. Yeah.
Fucking so good.
Yeah.
He gets so mad at me when we watch Dateline because usually like midway through, I'm like, oh, he did it. And this is why.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, do you think you legitimately could aid an investigation?
I probably could.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like you should. Cops do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They don't solve shit. So like, I think I can aid an investigation. You know, what's funny is like, I can't believe I'm telling you this, but I always had this fantasy of like going to a small town like Stephen King writes or something and like being like, I'm going to spend my summer here writing a screenplay. And then right when I get there, a murder happens.
Ooh.
Yes.
So I spend the summer having to clear my own name. It's like, oh, the new guy came and there's a murder in town. So.
Right. And he's writing a horror movie. And...
That's another movie in
there's
itself.
A movie. Yeah. But meta.
You know, I love Dateline as well. And we have.
I almost want to get murdered on this Zoom.
So Michael can solve it.
And yeah, write a movie about it.
We had Josh Mankiewicz from Dateline on here.
Did you really?
Yeah, we interviewed him a couple months ago. And we loved him. He was great. Yeah. He was such
his suit, the guy that makes his suits made Brian and I suits for our wedding.
What?
Wow. How did that come up?
So I forget how we found him. I think our wedding planner recommended him to us, and then so we went to his website and there's pictures of Josh Mankiewicz all over it.
That's awesome.
I want to look literally like the guy from Dateline at that moment.
We were like, we gotta hire this guy.
your male model is Mank on your on your page. Awesome. That's funny. But I do notice something that they do on Dateline, and maybe you pick this up, and what's annoying to your husband is within the first 20 minutes of Dateline, they'll often say like, then Rebecca was in Sioux City living with her, you know, living with a roommate who came from San Jose. And then they don't talk about that roommate for 20 minutes. And you're like, it's that roommate they casually mentioned.
The roommate's coming back.
Right.
Yeah.
They love to do that.
They love to do that. It's like Law and Order SVU.
Yes.
They always like to do that too.
You drive past the murderer and then you go back to him.
Yeah. I also love SVU. My favorite thing that SVU does though is they try to throw the scent off you. So like say it's Julius is the actual killer.
Right.
They spend like 2 acts making it look like you, Alec.
Yes.
And instead of it just being like, I don't know, you're on the street or something, they end up finding out that like you have dead bodies in your house anyway. Like, you didn't commit the other crime, but you're like committing a really bad crime in the process. Also good.
I love SVU as well. So let's go back a little bit because you mentioned that you were working on Family Guy as a PA. How did that come about?
Mark Huntsman.
Oh, wow.
I moved to LA, and weirdly enough, my brother, his friend from high school, is a lawyer in Cleveland, and he worked for the same firm that Mark's dad worked at.
Oh, wow.
When I was moving, that chain kind of got connected, and I talked to Mark on the phone before I moved, and he said, when you get out here, let me know. I'll have you come in for a table read. So I did that, and then like a week or two later, there was a PA position open, and I interviewed for that. Didn't get it.
Right.
And then 6 months later, they needed a PA like in a day.
Wow. Or,
like, 2 days. It was like one a weird situation. I get a call from Kim Furtman, and she's like, can you come in tomorrow to meet with us? So I did. And then she's basically like, do you want the job?
That's
awesome.
We need you to start right away. So yeah, it was Mark. And then I ended up later on finding out that when that second occurrence happened, I guess Mark went into Shannon's office and was like, can you just hire that kid from?
Oh, that's nice. That's
awesome. Yeah.
We love Mark. We love Mark. We should have Mark as a guest on this program, but I wouldn't want to put you through it, JC, of cutting out all the uhs and ums.
I bet Mark doesn't remember that story either. So if you ask him.
Of course he doesn't. Yeah. So good job, Mark. God, so nice of him. He's such a nice guy.
He really
is. So I remember when you were at Family Guy, you gave me a spec script
that
you had written, and it was great. I don't remember exactly what it was off the top of my head, but do you remember what that script was?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that this morning. I was like, wait, didn't Alec? Because I was like, Alec was kind of responsible for me getting on Border Town. I remember it was called Sisters.
Right.
I think it was about two sisters that lived together, and they hadn't spoken to their youngest sister in like 5 years. And she shows up on their doorstep one day being like, I need a place to live.
Right, right, right.
She's
right.
Like a total cunt. Like,
my favorite word.
That's a great word.
Yeah. And so like the other two are just kind of like.
You just said a way better title than Sisters.
Turns out she's like pregnant. Her boyfriend is cheating on her and stuff. So like it was essentially the younger estranged sister.
This is how things work in Hollywood often, because you gave me the script. Yeah. I loved it. I thought it was great. I gave it to my wife, Tal, who was an executive at NBC. Yeah. And she wasn't at that time. I think she had just left, but she still had a lot of friends there. And she loved it. And she passed it along to them. And then NBC didn't hire you. Like,
I ended up meeting on it was Sean Hayes's like sitcom.
Something Saves the World.
Yeah, I think it was called Sean Saves the World.
Yeah.
Ended up meeting on that because of the script with Victor Fresco.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. I ended up meeting on that because of Tal and you.
Amazing.
Well, they should have hired you because that was it was a great script. And I mean, it's another classic case of like they got it wrong because the way things worked out for you, thank God they didn't hire you because you might be toiling as a co-producer on some NBC show that no one watches, but instead you've created
Dr. Monkey or some show.
Right. That was one of their shows. I forget. It wasn't called that, but it was something like veterinarian wacky guy.
I think about that a lot actually. Like, because of that spec though, Mark ended up getting it. And then I ended up talking to him about Border Town, and then he read another spec of mine. I had written an Always Sunny in Philadelphia script, and he had read that and then met with me and hired me on Border Town.
Awesome.
After Border Town, though, I had like a really low point. I like couldn't find work, and my agents didn't want to do anything for me. And then I ended up having to go back to Family Guy in production. I remember like coming back into the Family Guy with my tail between my legs, but I also knew like, I don't know, I needed to eat. Like needed to be able to get sick and not, you know, like be able to go to the doctor and stuff. So Shannon thankfully like brought me back in.
Yes.
And Kara and Shannon, they were really supportive.
Well, they're, I wanted to point that out too, because Kara, who you mentioned is Kara Vallo, who's our head of production, and Shannon is basically her right-hand woman. And they run the production side of the show so well, and they have always also been your champions.
Oh, like,
the way that they root for you and pull for you and try to help you was really great. So I mean, that was a blessing to get to work for them.
Honestly, like being going back was not only like super humbling, but also like a relief. It really, I don't know. It's, I tell friends this who struggle now. I'm like, you need, like, I think if you got a job, you'd feel really good about yourself. Like, I remember leaving days, not, or like going there and being like, writing, I want to be in a room, blah, blah, blah. But also leaving some days and being like, thank God for this place. Like, you know, it, and like, I remember when I started, Shannon's like, well, put Final Draft on your computer, even though you don't need it. And like, the job isn't going to be super demanding at times. So like, feel free to write. If you need to go to meetings, just let us know like the day before. Like they were so amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible.
I left to go. I like hadn't quit my job yet, but they let me leave to go to set for Freaky. Wow. Like Kara and Shannon were like, we'll put you on leave for a few weeks.
That's awesome.
So like I actually quit my job while I was on set because while I was on set, my second script sold.
Yeah.
So I called Shannon and gave my 2 weeks. And I don't think I would have done this in any other job. I actually flew back to LA and did my 2 weeks.
Oh, that's good.
I felt like I was my responsibility to help them find a person and also just not leave them hanging.
That's the Cleveland. That is the Midwest work.
So classy.
Lunch pail, blue collar.
Like I went to Atlanta for 3 weeks, came back to LA, did my final 2 weeks at Family Guy, and then went back to Atlanta for the final 3 weeks of the
show. You like head of IT when you came back? Like that's when I worked with you, that's what you were.
And I have no IT now. But Shannon told me what she really wanted, which they never had before, is they always had like a tech person running IT. So like just imagine a tech person doing clerical work.
But someone who did IT in the 90s, 99% of it is just restarting your computer.
Totally. Literally
every time.
IT.
That was how I helped. Did you try restarting your computer?
Yeah. Totally.
But they wanted, I'm super organized and like almost OCD when it comes to that kind of stuff. When I was Shannon's assistant, she was always like, thank God you're here.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I did for IT because I had no fucking clue.
I feel like is an alternate version of this is, you were so publicly known for writing about killing people that no one wanted to cross you for fear of being killed. Because I would be like, oh, we can't really fire that guy. All he does is think about murder all day.
I know, we'll wind up in a meat hook somewhere.
Yeah, he'll end up in a meat grinder. So yeah, I don't know. Like, I forget where this started, but I'm really thankful for.
You made a good point, which is, people who are struggling sometimes, you know, when I was doing stand-up, and there was 8 years of this where I was doing IT, I had to go to a job. A, it gives you insight into how people and your characters can function in the world, because that's what most people do. And B, it lights a fire under your ass because you 100%. Go, I don't want to be doing this.
Yeah.
And then C, it's good to have a place to go psychologically.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you feel good about your, I don't know, for at least for me anyway, it made me feel good about myself at the end of the day. Like, did I love it? No, but I also knew like it was 9:30 to 6. I wasn't going to be at the office till 10 o'clock ever. You know what I mean? Like, I knew it was very structured and stuff. And like, I don't know, it made me really, the way I put it now is like, it really made me appreciate the no's in my life. And, I was trying to put myself in a box.
I wish I could appreciate the nose in my life. I was going to say that.
But like, had I continued on Border Town, you know what I mean? And like, I wrote a pilot between Border Town and Freaky. Like I sold a pilot pitch to the CW and I actually wrote that at Family Guy as well too. And I was really bummed when it didn't go forward. But like, had that gone forward, Freaky never would have been made because
just
I would have
say it. You'd be us. You can say it.
It was an hour long. It was an hour long pilot. So I would have been stuck in Vancouver shooting that pilot. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I'm really thankful for the way it turned out because I was always trying to put myself in a box that I don't think wanted me and a box that I ultimately now look back on and don't want to be in. Like, I know myself now and I like found my lane and that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of that has to do with rejection. Like, I don't know. Rejection
can be great. How is it possible for you? What is it that motivated you and motivates you to keep writing? Like, for a lot of people, the fear of going back to a full-time job is to be like, I'm too tired to write. I'm too tired to do this. But it clearly you have a passion. But was there ever a time where that you kind of wanted to just be like, I can't write today?
Oh, so many times. And there'd be months when I was working at Family Guy the second time where I wouldn't write shit, you know, like I just didn't have it in me. I went through highs and lows, but I also thankfully had my husband. He was, you know, my boyfriend at the time. And like, he was very, very instrumental in all of this happening. You know, it was his idea when I was unemployed and looking for a TV writing, a half hour sitcom job or whatever. He read this script of mine, unbeknownst to me, this slasher movie I'd written. He read it and he like was like, this is a really good script. Like, what are you going to, you should do something with this. So I put together a big table read and stuff. Oh, wow. And like, I cold emailed big producers. Like I emailed Jason Blum, which you're not supposed to do. But at that point I was just like, fuck it. I don't care if someone gets mad at me.
Yeah.
And Jason Blum emailed back and was like, I'm going to send one of my execs. And they didn't buy the script, but I became friends with that exec. And then we started hanging out socially. And then like next thing you know, they're starting a podcast network. So then they asked me to start a queer horror podcast. So like that's, and then I got Chris Landon to come on that show through them. So that's how I met Chris. And that's how we became, you know what I mean? Like there's so many weird steps to all this.
That's great.
It's like, I'm really, so like, but there were definitely days where I was like, I don't want to do this. But then there was always the thing in the back of my head being like, I don't know what else to do.
Right.
Well, I don't have skills for anything else.
Well, Michael, God, you know, it's been so awesome just watching your rise, you know, because you are such a cool, funny guy, nice guy, good worker. And that's something that, you know, people notice, the writers notice when there's a good PA versus a PA who's just kind of like, you know, out of it and in it for themselves. You were always a good worker, a good PA. Then to have this talent at writing, which was evident from that early cunt script, I would say, you know, it was right away, we could all see that. So it's just so gratifying to see you doing what you want to be doing and doing it so successfully. So, Michael, thank you for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you.
And congratulations on all your success. And please come on again when you are releasing your next movie.
My next movie comes out, I think, next February. So,
all right. Well, that's too soon, but we'll have you on for the movie after that.
February 2025.
Okay.
Oh, okay. great. And then we're set. Let's book that. All right, Michael Kennedy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Oh, boy. Michael Kennedy, what a nice guy. So fun to talk to. Yeah. And I'm so happy for all his success.
Is he the best Kennedy out there now?
Oh, he might be.
Kennedy.
He might be way ahead of RFK Jr. that was fun talking with him. Thank you, Michael Kennedy. And now it's time for the part of the show we call Top 5.
Top 5.
Sound good. All right. This is my top five this week. Mine.
Ooh, yours.
And the top five this week are top five songs of this century. Top five.
May I ask you a question before we begin?
Yes.
Could a song come out in the year 2000 and be on this list, or is it 2001 and after?
Yeah. People love that debate. I think if it's 2000, you're safe. I think it's fine. Yeah.
Phew.
All right, here we go. Number five for me is a little ditty called As It Was by Harry Styles. Love that song. Love it, love it. Takes me to a very relaxing place. Number four is a song called Get Lucky by Daft Punk.
Yes.
Very catchy.
Yes.
Could listen to that one forever. And number three... by DJ Mark Ronson, Uptown Funk. Love Uptown Funk. Number two, and I had to really fight to not make all of these Radiohead songs. So the one that I picked at number two is a song called Weird Fishes.
I
love very much. And the number one song for me gets me very pumped up, and now I have to block out who sings it. Is Stronger by Kanye West.
Oh, wow. That's your number one.
It is.
Cool. All right.
JC, what do you got?
Okay. My number five is a song by Frank Ocean called Lost.
Okay.
So good.
I like my oceans, Billy. Thank you very much.
I also love Billy Ocean. My number four is a song called Maps. By the Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. That was in Rock Band. I remember hearing that all the time.
Oh, that's funny. I played that. I don't remember.
Ooh, overlap, yeah. Lap, laps.
Lap, lap, lap. Okay, number three by Childish Gambino. This is America.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh boy. Oh boy. Dak, it's just so powerful. Dak. Number two, Radiohead. Idiotech. Idiotech.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good one.
Oh my gosh. And my number one is a very female, very pop oriented number one, Britney Spears, Toxic. Yep. Oh, so good.
Okay, number five, and this is why I asked that question up top.
Yeah.
Yes.
Coldplay's Yellow.
Oh, so, I love that song.
We got the stars.
Number four, I alluded to overlap, and here it is. It's Over Map.
Over Map.
The song Maps by the Yeah.
Awesome.
Number three, 99 Problems.
Yeah. Nice. Very good.
Number two, Miley Cyrus, Wrecking Ball.
Oh, I almost had Party in the USA.
And number one, you're either gonna love me or hate me for this. I Stand By It. The song that tricks me into thinking I can dance. Blurred Lines.
Oh wow.
All right, it makes you feel a certain way. We respect that.
Yeah.
All right, Goldie, it's you next week. What do you got?
The top five side dishes.
Ooh. Oh. Have we had that? I don't think we have.
No, I don't think so.
Awesome.
I love it. Oh,
can be any ethnicity, any type of food.
Yeah, I love it.
Side dishes.
Love it.
There we go. Love it. Love me some sides. all right. Well, that was fun. We look forward to that next week. But now let's close the show as we do every week on a high note. Oh, Tom and Max, thank you very much. my high note, I'm sure this will piss Goldie off, but Goldie, my high note is you.
Oh.
Because not only did you just blow us away with that Golden Globes monologue last week, I was laughing about it all week and just was in awe of your talent and ability in that area, but also... We went to the TED premiere. You and I were seated right next to each other.
I love it.
And there was Goldie on the big screen in his part that he talked about, almost a year ago.
Yes.
Shooting. And you were awesome. You were very funny. And you did not have that thing that so many writer actors have where red lightitis, where when you're on camera,
you can
see it all over their face that they're not an actor. Yeah. I believed that you were an angry teacher in that moment, and I thought you did a fantastic job. So
yes,
Goldie
great.
Is my Thank high you. Note.
Wait, I'm sorry.
It's I appreciate that. Go ahead, Jason.
I wanted to go next because this was not planned. Not planned, but you are also my high note.
Whoa.
Yeah.
This is overkill.
Yeah, no, Feels because like I watched the TED premiere. No, it's literally written down, Goldie in TED. That's my high note.
There you go.
And Stu and I watched it. It literally, they should have a show just based on that character. I would watch that in a heartbeat. It was so funny. You were a scene stealer.
Yes.
And because you had mentioned you would be in another episode, I continued to watch all the episodes so I could see your next scene. And
was I cut?
No, you were not cut. You were amazing. It was hilarious. Yes.
I very much appreciate it. That's very kind of you both. It's funny. I was going to talk about this up top, but so the experience of seeing yourself on a gigantic screen. So I was like, okay, I'm fine with the performance. Like I wasn't critical at all. I wasn't like, I'm amazing, but I was like, okay, I did well enough that I'm not going to think about this anymore. I don't have to worry.
That says a lot.
Totally.
But what I was fixated on was I was like, oh my god, I have the droopiest eyelids. What the fuck? No. I was like, my eyes are so fucked up. One is lower than the other. They're so droopy. And then I was at the party afterwards and I was like, how am I even gonna talk to anyone? My eyes are fucking the weirdest things I've ever seen. And so I instantly understood how you become one of these plastic surgery monsters. Like, it's like, if I did this for a living, I would be like Kenny Rogers, where I would be like, my whole face would be peeled back. I would have doll hair to my eyebrows, and my nose would be like shaved because I was horrified.
You can do that?
And it's like, the character is this, you know, stupid teacher. So you go, yeah, it doesn't matter if you're not supposed to be handsome in that part. You're supposed to look like there's a sense of desperation. But I was horrified. And then when they went behind me and they showed the guy from behind, it's like the bald spot and the saggy butt. And I was like, oh my God, this is a disaster for me. But anyway, I do appreciate it.
It's funny. Now I'm remembering as we were walking out of the theater, you said that your eyes were off kilter. And I did not notice that.
No, yeah. I didn't. No,
that
was.
I mean, I locked in on that instantly.
Of course.
But I, you know, I'll just say my high note. I had something else planned, which is that, you know, I'll say two things, which is, you know, both my kids have now had COVID and the flu, and this is the first day in a month they're both at school, and that my wife really shouldered the burden of that and slept in their rooms with a mask on, etc. So hats off to her.
Yeah.
But I also want to say that having worked on Ted and now seeing the show, I thought the scripts were funny and the table reads were good, but you just never know.
I loved it, and
the show just went away because of the animation. That, like, we saw nothing for over a year, to the point where I was very concerned they're hiding it from us because they're trying to fix it or they don't know what to do. Or
no,
this show is so goddamn funny.
It is
really funny. Legitimately.
Yes.
Like, I'm very proud to have been involved with it. And I, you know, I just, I've now seen half the episodes, and it went from something that I was, you know, I didn't know how it was going to turn out, to just going, oh, this is really great in a way that you don't see a lot of comedies anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, that scene in the second episode where Ted is on John's shoulders in the overcoat and they're just destroying the store walking through it. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that for me.
It was very funny. Yeah. So it was very funny.
And I hope people are able to watch it.
Yeah, and it's setting all kinds of records on Peacock in terms of like most stream. Well, here's the thing. It set the record for most streamed original show on Peacock, and I was straining to think of one other. But
MacGruber.
MacGruber. Take that, MacGruber.
And Bupkis.
I'm gonna shoot.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, and Bupkis. That's Pete Davidson's show, Bupkis.
Oh, right.
Pete and Dave Cyrus, yeah.
Well, congrats to you, Goldie. Congrats to everyone who was involved with the Ted show, because, yes, as you said, it is really legitimately like hard laugh funny, which is not easy to do. Well, that was a fun show this week.
Yes.
Again, Michael Kennedy, you were awesome. Thanks for being here. Thank you all for listening. Thank you two for being awesome.
Thank you.
We will talk to you again next week.
Don't put a Jacob Elordi quote here.
And it stops right now.
Or did you just dream it like you always do?